As the business of sports continues to grow exponentially, the line between sports and entertainment continues to evaporate. In a nation besieged by seemingly insurmountable economic problems and the further fracturing of interpersonal bonds, sports and its simplicity, its clarity, and its team identity has become stronger than ever. Along with all of this has come billions of billions of dollars to the sports entertainment complex. How to maintain both the integrity of the business model and the purity and honesty of sports in light of this kind of money is certainly one of the questions of our time. Our guest today is a man who has been perhaps more aggressively than any other looking at these issues. He is David M. Carter. He's the executive director of the University of Southern California's Sports Business Institute. He's a professor of sports business at USC's Marshall School of Business and a principal of the Sports Business Group. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his latest book, Money Games, Profiting from the Convergence of Sports and Entertainment. David M. Carter, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Great to have you here. Has this notion of a kind of sports entertainment complex, is this something new, or is it just that there's more money at play right now? Is this something that has always been the case as long as there has been even the most tangential relationship between sports and entertainment?
Oh, I think it's gone back really almost since the dawn of time. If you take a look at some of the earlier facilities, whether in Rome or in Greece, or you fast forward today to places like London or Los Angeles or those cities where the Olympics or World Cup being held, it's pretty clear that it's always been around. I think the issue really today is if you're going to finance these multi-hundred-million-dollar facilities or otherwise try to incorporate entertainment into the sports experience, you better be able to get your money back out. And so I think the focus has really been on return on investment, on making sure that you're making money from these endeavors. And if you do that, then I think you've got a very compelling business proposition on your hands.
And, of course, like any business, it is a function of individuals and the culture of those organizations and individuals. To what extent have we seen, certainly in the past 50, 60 years, any kind of a fundamental change in the nature of individuals who come to play in these areas?
Well, you know, I guess there's a couple of ways to take a look at it. I think if you talk about playing from a business perspective, I think the sophistication has grown dramatically. It used to be kind of a mom-and-pop business. If you owned a team, maybe you also owned a tavern in the area or used sports to drive some of your other business interests. But as the dollars became so big and people realized they could also make money from ancillary real estate or from intellectual property and things like that, it really grew. And I think if you're looking at it from the standpoint of the fan and how they've grown over the years, I think one of the things that's pretty obvious is that they have this insatiable appetite for sports. They'll put up with just about anything. They're living vicariously through these athletes, through their favorite teams, even through their colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this marriage of fans always wanting more with an industry that can't wait to deliver it to them.
We've gone through sort of cycles of ownership over the years in that it was a mom-and-pop business, as you say, families that grew rich in this. Then for a while, conglomerates kind of took over the business, much the way CBS bought the Yankees. And then it sort of switched again to either rich individuals or really wealthy groups of individuals.
Well, that's right. And I think what happened along the way is for a decade or two, many corporations, whether you were Anheuser-Busch or in the brewing industry or more often than not, a media conglomerate, you saw that as your core competency. You could market and use the ownership of a sports franchise for business development purposes, whether that was selling more beer or being able to launch a regional sports network. But I think over time, these companies were getting pressure from shareholders. They were getting pressure from others suggesting that it wasn't really a core competency and they might be better off jettisoning some of these assets. And you started to see that. And again, that was happening at about the same time stock market was doing well, NASDAQ was up. So there was incredible wealth being generated on an individual basis, and many of those individuals, gentlemen like Mark Cuban and others, stepped up and became very active participants in franchise ownership. So I think you see that ebb and flow linked to the stock market, and I think you see it linked also to things like public policy and shareholder pushback.
Talk about public policy and what role that's played as this sports entertainment complex has continued to grow.
I think it's really fascinating, Jeff, because what has happened, and I think you see this in every sport, and I think one of the things we talk about in Money Games a lot is that sports and the business of sports is not that different from any other kind of business. Your goal, I guess, is to push the envelope as far as you can, make sure that you have shareholder buy-in, make sure you're obviously operating ethical and legally along the way, but you also want to push the envelope. And I think in sports, the goal there is to push the envelope right up until the point where you have to testify in front of Congress, whether that's antitrust, whether it's drug use, whatever it is. You want to be pushing the envelope. So the last thing you want to do is a sports league or a commissioner or even an individual athlete, as we've seen over the years, is find yourself on C-SPAN. That's the last place anybody in the sports industry really wants to be.
But, of course, that line is different for each individual sport. We've seen it different in the NBA than in Major League Baseball, for example.
Well, I think the tolerance level is very different. I think the history and tradition of the leagues very different. For instance, what might be acceptable sports marketing or sponsorship attached to things like the NBA or even European soccer would simply never fly in Major League Baseball. For example, putting corporate logos on jerseys or things like that, where you have a league that is a lot more conservative and has a stronger tradition. Yet Major League Baseball has done a remarkable job with developing their own advanced media division called BAM, Baseball Advanced Media, which is worth billions of dollars. So they've been able to monetize interest in their league in ways that others have not. And so, again, it gets back to this overall balance of sports and business, technology, and all the rest. But along the way, you really need to take the temperature of the fans. And I think what we're seeing today is that fans are willing to put up with excessive sponsorship, not just limited sponsorship, but rather excessive sponsorship, because many of them believe that allows these leagues and teams to keep prices low for tickets and concessions and the like. I don't think that's correct, but I think that's the perception.
What role, if any particular role, has the NFL played in pushing the envelope?
Well, I think the NFL has been dragging others along. Commissioner Goodell has done a remarkable job at brand building, at extending his brand. He does everything around that NFL shield. Many think he is micromanaging player indiscretions, yet you see the league also step up and take a very active role now in areas like concussions and dealing with the medical issues that end up impacting players long term. So I think you look at the stability of the NFL, obviously bringing in more money than any other league. They're wrestling with different issues. They're really the gold standard, and everybody's trying to understand how is it that they, too, can get the kind of corporate money, the kind of television money, be as entrenched as that league is in 32 cities around the country. They're really watching that very closely, and that's, again, why I think so many people are tuning in now to see what's going on with the labor negotiation in the NFL. So you have this, you know, $7, $8 billion business that may shut down for a year, and so I think how the NFL in that leadership position demonstrates that it can resolve an open labor issue is also going to have a big effect on the other sports and how they negotiate.
How do you think, from your perspective, the country would respond to that, fans would respond to that?
Well, I think they'd be furious. I think they'd be disappointed, obviously. And I also think that they're going to say, hey, you know, a pox on all your houses. I think they, in this economy, cannot relate to billionaire owners that are trying to extract subsidies from local cities to build stadiums at times when obviously there are other pressing needs. But they also equally, if not more so, can't relate to these players who complain and gripe and saying they're, you know, quote-unquote being disrespected because they're only making $10 million a year. So I have a hard time believing that either side is going to be able to really attract any kind of public favor. And I believe both sides know that, and both sides know that they would suffer a major setback if the league went dark. It certainly happened in the National Hockey League several years ago when
right.
they missed an entire season. They're still recovering. And I think that's not just going to be the case with the NFL if it goes dark, but think about these corporations. Think about the TV networks. They have had tremendous stability with the league. They've always been able to market their products and services, and it's been a great relationship between labor and management. And if it goes sideways in the next 6 months or so, I think the fans will be furious.
But in any case, it's going to be a game of chicken right down to the end.
Well, it is. I mean, there's really not great incentive to solve this really until you need to. I think there's been a tremendous amount of posturing. There's been a lot of politicking and a lot of bickering and soft proposals going back and forth and that kind of thing, trial balloons. You know, they're still dancing around a little bit, but they've got to get to the point where even if they don't resolve it soon, there is enough reason to believe that it will be solved so that the corporations don't begin to pull their spending.
Right.
You think about these corporations allocating advertising and sponsorship dollars well in advance, and if they have a belief that their marketing message might be compromised, they may ship those dollars elsewhere, and then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and problem for the league.
Given the scope of all of this, in all of these sports, and the billions and billions of dollars we're talking about, it is remarkable sometimes that there is even close to parity across the board in these sports.
Well, it is. And, you know, it's interesting, though, that parity really depends on how you want to define that. You know, if you're a fan, you want to believe that your team, your favorite team, has a shot, at least at the beginning of the season, of making the playoffs and maybe going deep into the playoffs. If you're a league and you're a league commissioner and you are charged with increasing the franchise value of all the teams in the league, which is really what the commissioners are charged with, building asset value like any leader, any business leader, well, the goal then is to have enough parity around the league so those fans believe they have a shot. But for them, ultimately, at the league level, they want to make sure that the big branded teams in the big metropolitan markets win more often than not, because that leads to increased TV ratings, and obviously that deals with increases in advertising rates and so on down the road. So fans want a different kind of parity. For instance, the NFL knows that their business partners, all of them, advertisers, sponsors, TV networks, even the sports agents and the players, they all know that they benefit long-term by having big market, big branded teams win more often.
How does this impact on owners and players? I mean, how is it different if you're playing in Nashville versus New York, and your awareness as an owner or a manager in the structure of those organizations?
Well, I guess there's two ways to look at that. From an ownership standpoint, many over the years that have been in small markets have complained that it's tougher to make a go of it in a small market. You don't have enough of a corporate presence, so you don't have the ability to generate as much money from suites and, you know, other premium seating and naming rights and that kind of stuff. But on the other side of that, you've got other owners in the big markets that said, hey, no one made you buy the Kansas City Royals or the Pittsburgh Pirates. The price of that team and all the business developments around it were baked into the purchase price. If you're a player, on the other hand, and you're playing in a league where there's a fair amount of salary parity, well, then it might come down to how do the endorsement markets differ, and Nashville obviously quite different than Chicago or New York.
I mean, this was sort of the underlying story that was really, I think, very much underreported in the whole LeBron James story last year.
Well, it was, and that, you know, you talk about money games, and it's about the convergence of sports and entertainment, and LeBron James may have been the epitome of that entire story for 2010. It was a complete circus. Obviously, he left quite a few fans disgruntled in one market, not well received, the handling of the announcement and all the rest as he went on to Miami, many rooting against the Miami Heat going forward. So it really stirred just about everything that is both right and wrong with sports these days. But it certainly reinforced what a big business it is, the extent to which these players have tremendous leverage once they've risen to the level of a LeBron James.
To what extent does TV and ESPN in particular play a major role in the emergence and the growth of this complex?
Yeah, it's fascinating. When we started this research, one of the things we reminded ourselves of very quickly is that the E in ESPN stands for entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take a look at their senior leadership, George Bodenheimer, president of ESPN, and many of the others that we interviewed for the book, including John Skipper, who's in charge of all content, so he creates some of these great programming elements like College Game Day and the like, you really begin to see how they are not just reporting on sports, but they are really determining what is important about sports. They are both pushing and pulling content like nobody else. ESPN has dozens and dozens of different business units. They just wrapped up, as you may have seen, a brilliant documentary set of 30 documentaries that were just amazing, critically acclaimed, well-received, well-done. I think it reinforced to many why ESPN is the market leader in that kind of space. And there's no reason to think that they're going to relinquish that space because they have their finger on the pulse of what the fan wants to hear about and wants to learn about.
Talk a little bit about the fan and the extent to which the fan doesn't really push back against all of this money that we see out there.
You know, I've been accused before, Jeff, of blaming the fans for what happens in sports, and I'll take that assessment because think about fans, think about pricing, think about the inconvenience sometimes of getting to games. Consider how athletes head into the stands and, you know, get into brawls and all the rest of it. Think about it then from a customer service standpoint, if fans were not fans but were customers of any other business, would they put up with that kind of behavior? Probably not. Yet fans, sports fans, always seem to, and the industry understands that. They know that, that the fan base has a very high tolerance level for poor service. And I think that these fans, they talk a big game about, you know what, we're not going to go, we're not going to watch, we're going to change our habits, viewing habits, et cetera, and they never do. So you hear fans and fan groups saying, we want a seat at the table. We want to be part of the process. We want the leagues and the TV networks to know what our position is. Well, it's pretty clear. Everybody knows what their position is. Their position is they talk a big game, but they never act on it. So the leagues and others have appropriately taken their views into account, and fans still feel disenfranchised, but they don't change their spending habits, so the industry continues to chug along.
What's been the impact to the whole sports entertainment complex from, on the one hand, the decline of print, the decline of newspapers, and the rise of the internet and all of the various sports things that are attached thereto?
It's been fascinating to watch. Fans, almost regardless of age, have lived vicariously through their favorite teams and athletes for a very long time. Now, with new technology, with social media, with microblogging, all the rest of it going on, they feel even closer to their favorite athletes and their favorite teams. And it is largely, I wouldn't say it's largely a one-way relationship, but again, it's sports' ability to deliver that intimacy or that presumed intimacy to fans all over the world whenever they want and however they want it. And that's, I think, strengthened the bond between fans and sports. And certainly it's had a major impact on those in the sports world, including the sports media, that are less agile and don't have the ability to adjust quickly the way some of these other firms in the new technology space have.
And we've seen this whole rise in gaming and fantasy leagues, which has just further accentuated all this.
Well, again, when you think about the convergence of sports and entertainment, and a couple of things that we spent some serious time researching and talking about in the book Money Games, deal with things like fantasy sports and gambling, two things that are among the critical engines for the popularity of the NFL, and yet the NFL does not get all that actively involved in either. Clearly, they discourage gambling. They have staunch policies regarding gambling. But, you know, you think about the role of Las Vegas and the point spreads and the office pools week to week, and it's undeniable that gambling is a huge part of this. And, you know, to take that one step further, you could argue that fantasy sports, you know, where you draft your own players and have your own league with friends or colleagues, is also a form of gambling because, you know, more often than not, you're playing for some sort of prize. And so, you know, part of the success and the underpinning of the NFL and other sports tend to be fantasy sports and gambling. And when you think about gambling, again, from a convergence standpoint, people get to go to Las Vegas. It's helping their economy. Fantasy sports has been a big part of how Yahoo Sports and other web portals have built huge traffic over the years. So, again, it's not just the direct players in sports that are making money from it, but it's all of those around it.
And, of course, given how much money is at play, it's not surprising that this is all filtered down in many ways to college sports.
No, it's really not. I think what in fact, is on the horizon is, because what you're saying is true, that the money is enormous from the college basketball tournament, from the college bowl games, and all the rest of it. The debate rages about whether these athletes should be paid, and it continues to rage about whether you know, what's the right level of commercialization of college athletics. Should there be logos on athletes' jerseys? What happens with things like intellectual property rights? If I walk into a college bookstore and my favorite college player's name is actually on a jersey, shouldn't he get a part of that? So as the money becomes even bigger and bigger in college athletics, you're seeing some pretty important legal issues arise dealing with who controls content, who controls likenesses, and that then also gets into the area of video gaming. There's a rather significant lawsuit going on now in that space dealing with college athletics and Electronic Arts. And so, again, it's not just who's directly involved in sports, but all those that service it or are hoping to make money or build shareholder value out of it.
How are colleges responding to this? How are they going to stand up against this pressure, or are they?
Well, I think, you know, I think they can for a while, because I think that it's going to take a generation or two more of old school, so to speak, university presidents, trustees, chancellors, And, you know, they're going to have to move on and probably be replaced with more progressive business people running the universities, running the athletic departments and the like. And we're starting to see that transition. I think that change in senior management, both at the national level and also conferences and school to school, also going to be met with ongoing litigation, which is going to continue to move the needle a little bit more toward the players being able to benefit in some fashion. I think the era of being able to get away with saying we're providing them a scholarship and a stipend in exchange for the ability to get an education, I don't think that's going to fly forever.
Where are we seeing that leadership in terms of college athletic programs and college athletic directors who understand this?
Well, you know, it used to be that if you had won a Heisman Trophy or you were a legacy, you know, athlete for that university, you had a chance to become that athletic director because they weren't compelling commercial enterprises. You know, again, as new media emerged, as the evolution of college conference TV networks became the norm, as sponsorship really became significant for bowl games and individual franchises at the college level, the need to bring in business people to run these enterprises became pretty substantial. You take a look at athletic departments like the University of Texas or Ohio State, for instance, you know, well over $100 million annual budget just for the athletic department. Here in Southern California, USC and UCLA's budgets are in the $85 million range. And so you can't have some former jock with no formal training in business shepherding those enterprises because they don't understand the sophistication. They might be good at fundraising, which remains vital and, mm-hmm. and among the most important things an athletic director can do, but you can't just glad hand. You have to know how all the pieces fit together. So you're seeing athletic directors at Michigan and at USC come in from not an athletic background, but from a hardcore business perspective.
Talk a little bit about the impact that globalization is having on this whole arena. Certainly David Beckham is a case in point. The Dubai sports city is part of it. We're seeing this now expand on an international basis with big money everywhere.
Well, when we set out to write Money Games, we knew that the need existed for us to tackle this on a global basis because due to technology and just the historic internationalization of sports with things like the Olympics and the World Cup, we needed to incorporate what was going on a global basis. And we spent about a third of the book talking about international examples. You mentioned Beckham and the Dubai Sports City, which we were able to visit for a week, which was a fascinating trip. And we got to see some of the most outrageous and intriguing sports facility design and development that has ever taken place. And I think the athletes understand that. They know that they have a chance to build global personal brands to sell product the way David Beckham has, the way Kobe Bryant and Dwayne Wade have in the NBA, and all the rest of it. So the athletes understand there's money to be made on a global basis because there are no borders in business anymore. The NBA is really trying to get into Asia even further. They have offices all over the world. NFL is playing games abroad. Major League Baseball is doing the same. They understand that from a revenue standpoint, from a brand building and an asset value perspective, the growth might be limited domestically, but it's off the charts abroad. And if you can manage that and understand the cultural differences and how politics might be different in some of these issues and how business gets done in foreign markets, there's tremendous upside for the leagues and for the players. The issue will be, can those two work together to make sure that the sport continues? Because the more money flows in, the greater the chance for longer-term labor strife. And if they don't get their hands around that, they're going to miss a huge opportunity.
How does you respond, and how does everybody respond to the sports purist out there that simply can't get their arms around all of these things we've been talking about?
Well, you know, part of me is that sports purist, but I think, like everything else these days, at some point the nostalgia perspective just simply has to be replaced. And I think they are really a thing of the past. Very hard to protect it at a time when who is driving sports entertainment? It's young people that are demanding how and when they get their sports information and news, and it's corporations who are entertaining at the venues and are very concerned about business-to-business marketing dealing with sports, even more so maybe in some cases than business-to-consumer marketing. That's why they have the suites. That's why they have these premium seating locations at these venues. They're there to conduct business. And I think those kinds of things begin to paint the picture of why that purist is more of a thing of the past.
What do we know about the changing demographics of sports these days?
Well, it depends on the sport, to say the least. It depends on the sport. But I think one of the things that you're seeing is a huge internationalization taking place, whereby the leagues are importing players from all over the world. We're beginning to export players. You're seeing our young people, including women who've had the opportunity to grow up and take advantage of Title IX and gender equity legislation, have greater participatory opportunities. So you're really seeing sports at all levels expand, locally, regionally, and then, of course, across the globe. And you take a look at the announcement of a couple of weeks ago that talking about the World Cup going to Qatar and also to Russia, it's really quite amazing. It's the one thing, sports is, that can simultaneously unite and divide the entire world, and I think that's what generates so much interest in it.
And are young people, I mean, obviously it's different per different sports, but is there enough of a younger audience coming on board to continue to support all of these economic levels in various sports?
That's a great question. I think one of our big challenges in the industry is that as prices have gone up to attend games and younger families, a family of four now that would like to go to a hockey game or a baseball game, it costs them about the same amount of money to go to a game as it would be for a couple of weeks' worth of groceries or a minivan payment. And I think they're making tough decisions. And I think the sports industry has to get their hands around what happens long-term if these kids never show up at the stadium, they can't smell the grass, they don't see the players, in person and live and can't make that connection the way their parents did. And so I think that's why you're seeing leagues and sports in general throw so much time and interest at cultivating young fans. They've got to do it, and they may not be able to do it at venues. So they're doing it through TV programming. They're doing it through different online mechanisms and sports-related websites that resonate with young people. If they're priced out of the stadium, if they chase them out of the stadium, they better be able to chase them onto their couches or onto their computers, or you run the risk of losing that next generation of fans. And if you do that, sponsors, advertisers, TV networks, everybody involved says, wait a minute, is this where we should be spending our money?
But that begs the question of how important it is to get them in the stadiums at all. I mean, as everybody has their, 50-plus-inch televisions and home entertainment systems and everything else, and it gets more expensive to go to the stadium, what happens as fewer and fewer people want to make that effort that you talked about earlier?
Well, I think what happens is it shifts the business model to one where the turnstile is not nearly as important as the dollars generated by media, whether that's traditional media or new media or whatever else might come along. So I think that also then begins to impact labor negotiations long term, because the old model was that the players are going to get a certain percentage from all these revenue streams, and if you see a fundamental shift in those revenue streams, the athletes and others are going to want their fair share out of it. And so I think everybody's watching what happens at venue, and I think because some of these families are getting priced out and because it's becoming expensive and maybe inconvenient, you're seeing most of these facilities try to position themselves, if not truly position themselves, as an event experience where you can spend the entire day. There's a movie complex next door. There's plenty of restaurants and dining and shopping to be had. You can't rely just on the game itself. You have to really focus on the entire game day experience. That's how you get families out of the house and get them down to the stadium or the arena for the day.
Because the alternative to that is more of a pay-per-view model.
Well, it is, but then again, it gets back to something we talked about a little bit earlier, which is what's the role of public policy in that setting?
Right.
Arguments for a long time about would the Super Bowl ever be on pay-per-view, or would the government come in and essentially say, not literally, but essentially say the Super Bowl is a public good and it can't migrate to pay-per-view. Well, I got news for you. ESPN is pay-per-view. We all have a cable bill.
Right.
So it really depends on what your definition is of pay-per-view. Now, I understand what you're suggesting, where you pay your $50 to watch the game, and we're not going to get there for a long time. But that pay-per-view model is working brilliantly in mixed martial arts. It continues to work in boxing and wrestling and elsewhere. And so, again, depends on the business model and depends on what your relationship is with your athletes.
David M. Carter, the book is Money Games, Profiting from the Convergence of Sports and Entertainment, just out from Stanford University Press. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it was fantastic. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.